Joining us now is Dr. Alan Hale. He's the director of the Southwest Institute for Space Research, and his name will be familiar to a number of you from that comet. So we're going to talk about discovering comets and various other things. Alan, glad you could join us.
Thank you.
Let's first talk about that comet that has your name. How did that discovery go?
Complete accident, actually. Visual discovery. I was actually in my driveway, part of a regular program I have of observing visual observations, brightness estimates, what have you, of known comets in the sky that I've been maintaining for many years. Rainy season in New Mexico in July, actually. Mm-hmm. And very few clear nights. You have a clear night, you take advantage of it. So I was collecting observations of two comets that were in the sky at that time, and I had finished with one. I had an hour to wait before the other one rose above the house, so I had some time to kill.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just looking at objects in the sky just to pass the time.
Mm-hmm.
And near one of the objects I had decided to take a look at, on really kind of a spur of the moment, there was this other object next to it.
Uh-huh.
And let's say my agenda for the evening changed slightly.
Yeah, now you were not the only discoverer of that comet.
Correct.
How'd that happen?
A gentleman named Thomas Bopp, who's an amateur astronomer who lives near Phoenix, was that very same evening in the desert south of Phoenix with some of his friends, with some telescopes, and they were kind of doing the same thing I was doing. They were just looking at objects in the sky, and they happened to look at the same object I had decided to look at, and Tom saw the same little object that I did.
Chance favors the prepared mind.
Perhaps it does.
The pleasure, the excitement of having discovered a comet, though, has to have been altered by the fact that those wackos decided to use it as an excuse to commit suicide.
Yeah. They were looking for something by which to make their final exit or give them an excuse to make their exit.
Yeah.
And the comet happened to fulfill that need. If it hadn't been that comet, it would have been some other object. Will say, in reference to the events last month, I will say one thing in defense of the Heaven's Gate group,
mm-hmm.
and that was at least they had the decency to only take themselves.
There is that.
Yes.
There is that. I still think they were wackos.
But as misguided as they were, they didn't feel like they had to take anyone else with them.
Yeah, there is that. There is this thread that seems to run through society where, there's a mystical thread that seems to run through society. Today, the mysticism is expressed as, you know, aliens from Zeta Reticuli or whatever. Why is it that it is so easy for people to fall into mysticism and so hard for them to be attracted to science?
I know, that's,
what is the appeal of mysticism?
I think because it's easy and it offers simple answers to complex issues. Most issues in life are complex in one way or another, and I think perhaps genetically we're lazy. We don't like to invest a lot of effort in exploring the complexities behind the numerous life issues, and if someone or some philosophy or some religion, some whatever, offers simple black and white answers to these complex gray issues, people have a tendency to want to seize upon that.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, that's, and that in itself is a simplification of a complex question. So.
Yes. We will discuss a complex issue, but first let us simplify it.
Okay.
I also wonder if it involves the fact that in science, fundamentally everything in science has to be tested, whereas in mysticism and other areas of life, testing is not something that is required. It is express an idea and express it eloquently, vehemently, or repeatedly, and people believe it. Whereas in science, you observe the world, you come up with an explanation for what you've seen, and then you test it, and if your theory for what happened doesn't survive the testing, you throw it out and come up with something new. That requirement that things be tested is something that you don't find in mysticism and in all the other things.
That, I think, is a pretty significant part of the whole issue here. People do not like to give up cherished beliefs, however they've acquired those beliefs. And you encounter this in science, too, to some extent, where you embrace a particular idea or particular theory for so long, and eventually it's shown to be incorrect. Even scientists we're human.
Hey.
And we have a hard time giving up our cherished ideas, and we're supposedly trained to be able to do this, and we still have trouble doing it. So a lot of people who aren't necessarily scientifically trained have minds that run in the scientific track. It's human nature to latch on to those things which comfort us, and then we don't want to give them up.
Yeah. But scientists, even if they want to not change because they are human, they are trained to eventually accept the fact that, yes, my theory doesn't work.
Yeah.
I got to throw it away.
In an ideal scientific climate, yeah, that works. And generally, sometimes it may take a while. It may take a generation of science to do that. And there will, you know, there'll be a holdover or two. But eventually, the scientific consensus does change, and the scientists are more or less forced to go along with it.
But even when there's a new theory that's trying to usurp a previous theory and there are people holding on to the other one, the goodness that falls out of that is that by challenging the new theory, then it makes people work harder to make sure that their new theory does, in fact, explain the things it needs to explain and that it does survive the testing. So that in itself is not a bad thing. It just means people have to work harder.
Right. And I believe that we should challenge our deeply held beliefs at every opportunity. If you'll let me tell a quick story here, this was a few years ago when I was in graduate school. In fact, it was right around the time I finished up. There was a big to-do in my little neighborhood where I live where someone claimed they saw an image of the Virgin Mary on their bedroom wall, and there were people coming from all over the country, even other parts of the world, to come view this manifestation. And I thought it was at best a false report, because I don't believe in that type of mystical report. But I also felt like, you know, let's go check this out. What kind of scientist am I if I'm not even willing to challenge my deeply held beliefs? So I snuck over there one night, right when the lines were dying down, and talked my way into seeing this manifestation. I thought it was just an illusion of everything. So it reinforced my held beliefs. And I was able to reinforce it by actually challenging them and going to witness this thing.
Why is it when people see a face, it's the Virgin Mary and not Hannah the harlot?
People see what they want to see. I mean, we see it in the shapes in the clouds, the face on Mars.
Yeah. I remember something Arthur Clarke once said about UFOs. And he said, if you look up in the sky very often and you've never seen a UFO, you obviously haven't been looking very hard. And what that meant is that, in fact, there are any number of weird, strange things to be seen in the sky. Now, some of us will see them and then say, oh, lenticular cloud. Or you will see it and you'll pretty instantly categorize it as what it is. Whereas other people might look up there, see that, and see a great disc from Zeta Reticuli. But the fact is, there are many things to be seen. Some people can categorize them.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we had a display of the aurora in my part of the world not too long ago. We do not get auroras at my latitude very often. And so I look out there and I see a beautiful aurora display, and a person that's not as astronomically minded as me calls in the local newspaper and reports a UFO.
That happened out here in Los Angeles a year or so ago. There was a rocket launching out of Vandenberg. It was in the summertime, and it was the right hour. And if they launch just after sunset, you get the most incredibly, wonderfully beautiful display, because the rocket climbs up, and it is high enough to be illuminated by the sun while you're seeing the black sky behind it. And you get these wonderful clouds, just the most dazzling light display. I watched the rocket launch. I saw the cloud that followed, and the cloud hung around for, you know, 15, 20 minutes, and the winds gradually dispersed. And I looked at that, and I knew what it was. I got a call from someone that night asking if I had seen this UFO that was hovering over the West Valley, and it was huge, and it was, you know, it must have been 500 feet across, and it was hovering. The person described a little bit of it, and I said, oh, and did you see, bing, 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 and I described other things, aspects of this cloud, and she said, yes, you saw the UFO too. And I had to explain to her that, no, it may have looked like it was a flying saucer hovering over a field. Trust me, it wasn't. It was a cloud 200 miles away, 70 miles up or something. And it was still as beautiful for me. I don't think she wanted to believe it wasn't a UFO. But, Alan, I know we are very short on time, as you have to catch an airplane to go somewhere, so we won't have much time to talk. But I heard just the other day that there's been an amazing new comet discovery, or a comet discovery that could be pretty interesting.
Certainly.
And we will say could be pretty interesting, because it was just discovered, and comets are notoriously...
Absolutely, yeah.
They have their own mind about what they're going to do.
Yes. Yeah, so this is the comet discovered 2 months ago by the Near Earth Asteroid Tracking, or NEAT, program, which is run by Eleanor Helene at JPL. Actually, the program uses several telescopes, one of these being the Large Schmidt Telescope at Palomar, and which was the instrument, if I remember correctly, that discovered this particular object, a comet out beyond the orbit of Saturn. Took a while to pin the orbit down. Still not pinned completely down, but I think it's pretty accurate to within a few days when it's going to be nearest the Sun and Earth. According to these orbits, it will be nearest the Sun and Earth in May 2004. So we're 2.5 years away from its bright display. It'll be about as far from the Sun as Hale-Bopp was at its closest. It'll be 4 times closer to the Earth than Hale-Bopp was when Hale-Bopp was close. It does not, at this stage, appear to be as bright intrinsically as Hale-Bopp. But on the other hand, the fact it comes much closer to the Earth may counteract that to some significant extent. But as you have pointed out, there's no real way to predict how this particular comet's going to behave from 10, that as far out as it is right now, into the next 2.5 years. It could brighten tremendously, become a brilliant comet. It could completely fizzle. Our knowledge base of how comets behave from those distances out to small distances in our solar system is very, very small. We've only seen 2 comets at any distance like this that have come in close, Hale-Bopp being one of them, Halley being the other one because we knew where to look. So this thing could be bright. It could be a fizzle. It doesn't even have a sexy name like Hale-Bopp. It's got a real neat name.
Oh, God. Just neat 25. Yeah. They should use combinations of letters because then they could end up having comets with names like Neatnik.
Yeah.
Or something. The brightness of a comet is going to depend on how large the coma is. But that can be influenced by subtle factors. Does there happen to be a pocket of volatiles that gets vaporized? Or does the rotation of the comet's axis have it pointed such that very few volatiles get released? And so it could come in and it could release a lot of gas and have a big coma, big tail, and be very spectacular. Or it could come in and just, due to the accidents of timing, not release a lot of gas and dust and not be spectacular. And the only way to know is to wait.
That's right. You've got to see what it tells us.
I will cross my fingers that it will be spectacular because there is no sight like a naked eye comet.
Right, yeah. I will go out and actually predict that it would reach naked eye visibility even now, but naked eye visibility could be 6th magnitude, which is dark skies, you know, high in the middle of nowhere, and knowing exactly what you're looking for.
Yeah. Halley's Comet was disappointing to a number of people because it was so far away
that
it was basically just a smudge in the sky.
Yeah. It was actually a decent object if you were in a dark sky and knew where to look. And if you, it was actually deep in the southern sky when it was nearest the Earth and brightest. And if you were like me and trekked down to Australia, it was actually not a bad sight from there.
From the northern hemisphere, it was not impressive the way some comets can be.
Right.
On the other hand, I went to Hawaii. When I saw it, I understood why comets were originally called hairy stars. Because when I looked at it, that's exactly the word that came to mind.
Yeah.
Because it was just this smudgy thing in the sky, and you looked at it, and it's like, my God, it's hairy. Well, I'm hoping that this new comet will be spectacular. Are you continuing to look for new comets?
At this point, not really. I mean, now with programs like Linear and NEAT have come online and are picking up the vast majority of comets well before they are detectable by smaller instruments and visually. Now, having said that, there was a Canadian amateur astronomer who accidentally discovered a comet 2 months ago that somehow managed to pick up a comet all these other programs missed. It was an accidental discovery on top of that and was not looking for comets. I was able to confirm that comet. I was the people at the Central Bureau, the organization that Brian Marson, who you spoke to last night, used to head up. And you know, that he's retired from that position. Dan Green runs that organization now. Asked me to, along with a few other people, see if we could find this thing and confirm it. I was successful at finding it the next morning. Was able to get some the very earliest positional measurements for that thing. Turns out to be a short period comet. Comes around every 5.5 years. Somehow it's been missed in all previous returns, and all these other comprehensive sky survey programs missed it, but this amateur astronomer in Canada managed to accidentally stumble across it. So it does happen from time to time. There are, I think, some areas that are, some comets that are coming in that are being missed, some very tiny ones that are only detectable when they're near Earth or when they're near the Sun. The champion comet discovering program right now is actually the coronagraphs aboard the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, or SOHO, spacecraft that's detecting a number of very tiny comets very close to the Sun.
Because when they get very close to the Sun, they get bright because they're close to the Sun, and also because the volatiles have been driven off, increasing the size of the coma in the tail.
And only there are they bright enough, theoretically, for instruments to be detected. Of course, we cannot detect them from the ground when they're right next to the Sun, but a coronagraph in space is able to do so.
Because a chronograph is blocking out the light from the body of the sun.
Right.
Just letting you see the atmosphere of the sun and things around it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's leave on just one last question. In astronomy, in studying the stars, the planets, the asteroids, all those things in that great black abyss on the other side of the sky, what is it that brings you the most joy?
Oh, boy. I don't know. There's many number of things. I thoroughly just enjoy observing comets. I've been doing that for over 30 years now. I enjoy doing that and just looking at new objects and looking at old objects. I enjoy working in the space business and being a part of that. I like to think that I'm making a difference in some of the work I do. For example, I've taken the two groups over to Iran in the last couple of years to interact with my scientific colleagues and astronomers in that country. I feel like I'm opening the doors a little bit between our respective cultures and accomplishing some things beyond science. So I get enjoyment out of that. As far as which thing makes me feel best?
What evokes that emotion of joy?
Probably just nothing more than just being out under a clear, dark sky in the mountains somewhere where I live. Very simple.
Very simple, very complex. Thanks a lot, Alan. Nice talking to you. We'll talk to you again sometime.
Okay.
Thank you.